First you want to kill me, now you want to kiss me. Blow.
Hey, you've got 3 seconds for it.
I'm going to amp this baby up, see how it sounds.
Hey everyone, this is the FakeShemp.net podcast. My name's Glenn.
I'm Jared.
I'm Sean.
And we are coming to you from the prestigious Cinema Digan.
Yes, Cine Delgan, as it's known around these parts, Moorabbin.
Otherwise known as Jared's place.
Yes, my place.
Jared's beautiful. It is a beautiful house, by the way.
Thank you, sir. It's a rental, but I'll take it.
It's nice and cozy.
Yeah, it is.
So thank you all for listening. You can catch us, of course, on iTunes, Podbean and Stitcher. We're on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, also now on SoundCloud.
Yeah, SoundCloud. We're on SoundCloud.
You were getting a bit ahead of yourself there, weren't
you? Yeah, I was looking at the icon for this episode and I was like, wow, SoundCloud. How's that working out?
I haven't kept tabs because I haven't had the fucking internet for 7 weeks.
Where are you at in the internet situation?
Got yesterday.
Oh my god, dude. You've been making up for some lost time. I'm surprised you're even here.
I know. There's a long story I can tell you afterwards.
Right,
but yes,
okay.
No, I'm back.
But you do
in
have
action.
The internet.
Yes, and I'm back in action. So.
Incredible. There you go.
Anyway, so I haven't been able to keep tabs on the SoundCloud. So if you listen to us through there, please let us know. Mm. Drop a comment. We love the comments. That would be great. And so we've got an episode for you that kind of wraps up, I guess, the unofficial trilogy of high school related focus films.
I didn't even realize that there was a tenuously linked trilogy, but you're right, it was.
Yeah, so we'll get to that in a little bit. Anyone want to talk about what they've seen lately?
Yeah, Sean, what have you seen recently? You were just telling me a minute ago you caught up with the Brad Pitt, Angelina Jolie.
I did. I saw By the Sea, finally. Choose your words carefully, big boy. It's by no means a great film.
Right.
Right? But it's certainly not the train wreck that everybody would have you believe.
Yeah.
Right? The problem with it is it's a story about a couple in the 70s who go to this little seaside town in France because he's a writer and he wants to get inspiration and she kind of tags along. But the problem with it is it's 2 hours long, and when we start the film, this couple is like hanging on to the relationship by a thread. Like it's next to done and over and dusted. By the time the film finishes 2 hours later, they're in an even worse position.
Right.
Well, she's been pretty prolific. She pumped that out pretty fast after Unbroken.
Yeah, Unbroken wasn't that long ago.
And then they were within a year of each other.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing.
And as a director, she's actually pretty capable.
Yeah.
Right? She's not a bad director.
Unbroken was good.
I haven't seen it. That looked like Oscar bait to me. I just avoided it.
Oh, did you? Okay.
Yeah. Was it worth it?
I thought it was.
It's actually
based on the true story of Mick Garris's father-in-law.
Is that why Mick Garris was involved?
He produced it, Anyway.
Now, can you tell me this, though, Sean? In 30 years' time, when the film is remade with the same-sex couple...
Yeah.
You know, is the internet going to be outraged? Are the fanboys going to be upset?
The trans boys?
It depends.
I don't know. You might have to cut that out. will they be upset? Because obviously this week, opening in theatres in Australia, in the world over, except for China, as I posted an article on the FakeShemp.net Facebook, it's been banned in China. Ghostbusters. Yeah. Amazing, but brilliant.
Banned in China.
Did you see Ghostbusters? I know this guy saw Ghostbusters. I'm dying to know what he's...
Who made a segue that made no sense just now?
Yeah. I was getting into it.
Master of the segue, he is not. No, I haven't. I haven't seen it yet. I do want to see it. I just haven't seen it yet.
Okay, so an ongoing discussion at the start of our podcast for the last few episodes has been Ghostbusters and how they haven't really... captured our attention the way they probably hoped.
Yeah, yeah.
So we've seen it. We won't go into spoiler territory for anyone that's listening that wants to see it. Thoughts?
I didn't hate it.
I didn't like it either.
I didn't hate it. My main problem, and I did put this out on the net when you asked me, Sean, what I thought of it, was I just felt the film was... It was too comical and all four leads... were all comical. There was no center of balance.
McKinnon was the best
serious.
Thing about it, I thought.
Which one was she?
The one with the glasses and the quirky one.
I really didn't like her.
I loved her. I thought really she like was her. The only thing that made sense in this universe with these women as Ghostbusters.
I didn't hate her, don't get me wrong.
No,
I didn't like
but
her.
But I thought if she had been the only one playing the comedy role, it would have been a much stronger film.
Yeah.
But I do think that every scene doesn't need a punchline.
No, that's the thing. Yeah. And that's when you get, and no spoilers, I'm not saying anything, but when you get 3/4 into the movie and the jokes dry up a bit, you're just left with the rest of the film. And the balance is all out. And I'm kind of like, well, the jokes are kind of stopped. And they weren't that funny. And
the biggest disappointment for me was the first 15 minutes were fantastic. I really,
yes,
really
got absolutely. The first 15 minutes were great. And in my, I just felt like...
You're in Ghostbusters
world. I was so in, totally in the zone. And I was loving it.
Yeah.
And it was a great balance of suspense and humor. And the
and
effects
horror.
Were great. Yeah, it was all done so well. I'd even go as far to push it, you know, I'd say the first 25 minutes, even when they introduced some of the characters. But as soon as I knew that everything would have a punchline, that's when I was like, well, this is going to run out of momentum.
And it becomes a cartoon.
Absolutely. And then they introduced the character. Now, I apologize, I don't know the actress's name, the girl that's working for the MTA. She works for the New York
Train Leslie Jones.
System. Is it Leslie Jones?
Yeah.
Did not enjoy her in the film at all.
She yells the whole time.
It's just too much. Yeah. And as soon as she came into it, it took a sharp turn.
That's exactly how I felt with Deadpool. And that's that was my exact problem with Deadpool. I can relate to that. Just exhausting, like relentless, just every
but
single shot.
But I guess the difference there is that Deadpool...
Ryan Reynolds pulls it off because he's a god.
That is Deadpool on paper.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, right. Whereas we've all grown up with Ghostbusters 1 and 2 and even the real Ghostbusters, the animated series from the 80s. I will go as far to say, I actually gave it a 6 out of 10. I know you don't do the rating thing unless it's on real world.
If I had to, I'd probably give it a 6.5.
I gave it a 6 out of 10 because I will definitely watch it again, but I need at least 18 months before I watch it again and we'll just see how it sits. But some of the delivery and the interplay between the three of the leads was brilliant.
Yeah. There's a lot of merit to it. The Harold Ramis nod was fantastic.
Yeah.
Like, it was so fleeting, but it just... put you in ease. You know, they referenced him and that was nice. And everyone else makes, you know, an appearance here and there.
Actually, I will say though, Hemsworth, I really didn't like that character.
I hated him.
That character was...
full retard.
Awful. Yeah, absolutely full retard. And again, we're in that predicament that if you flipped... I know there was a little bit of sexism in the original with Bill Murray and how he's... but he's suave and he's smooth and he's a little bit sleazy.
Obvious.
And it's obvious.
Yeah.
Whereas this is just brainless. Absolutely brainless. They totally could have lost him. Like, he started off and he was funny. Then it just, went full retard.
You're playing into their palms here.
Who's this? Yes, of course.
Because my argument
was about Chris Hemsworth. You know, he's just, he's...
What they will say is, well, that's what's happened to women
for the last 30 odd years in cinema.
I had no issue with women being Ghostbusters. I thought they could have done it so well.
I just think it could have casted a bit better.
Yeah.
And I think they needed at least one of the central characters that played it straight was more like the Harold Ramis.
That dynamic is what just about every successful sitcom
in
the world is ever predicated on.
Right.
Seinfeld.
Yeah,
Seinfeld, 4 of them. There's 3 crazy and 1 straight. Friends, there's 3 crazy and 1 straight.
Yeah.
Because it has to be somebody, a yardstick of normality how mental these people are can be gauged against.
They're kind of aiming for Kristen Wiig to be that character. But she has these gags that just fall flat on her ass.
She's so goofy and gaga when she sees Hemsworth and things of that nature. But that said, she's probably my favourite character of the 4 leads in the film.
Yeah.
But she's just, relentlessly...
See, I think this film could have played a lot better as it is, should they have connected it with the original.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's no reason they could not.
This is a vision of the Ghostbusters, but this is the Ghostbusters in Chicago. This is the Ghostbusters. Yeah.
There's no
Detroit
reason
or,
it couldn't have been attached to the original trilogy.
No,
or original
absolutely.
2 whatsoever.
Because it fits. It's got the feel of the films. It's just it's the balance is way out in terms of comedy.
And the big difference
is
that this is
action.
Ivan Reitman versus Fig.
Yeah,
Fig,
absolutely.
However you pronounce his name. Yeah. So anyway, there we go.
But one thing I will say, glad that the theme, the horrible Fallout Boy featuring Missy Elliott theme, was kept to like maybe 45 seconds.
And I'm glad right at the start they played the original
theme. And then the variations of the theme throughout the film, I didn't find anywhere near as offensive as is this awful Fallout Boy cover. So yeah, look, I didn't hate it, and I will definitely watch it again.
Well, I'll tell you what was much worse. I thought Independence Day Resurgence was terrible.
Not seen it yet.
I really hated it.
Roland Emmerich is... He's
come on, you said he hasn't directed a good film since 94, and then we said Independence Day came out in 96, dude. What are you talking about?
Independence Day wasn't great either.
No, Independence Day was a whole lot of fun. Like, it's a fun. Big ball of fun. Yeah. This is ludicrous.
I don't think he's ever directed anything great, now I think of it. I think he directs good, fun movies.
Universal Soldier, I will have you know.
Oh, I don't know.
Nah, it's terrible. No. But each film he makes subsequently... He just tries to outdo the film before.
Right.
To get to the point where they are so large in scope that it is so unimaginable the things that are happening that it's hard to care.
Well, let's
Do you think he felt that he couldn't top 2012 and that's when he went, Anonymous?
There you go, but let's just wind that back because the film that slipped away from everyone was Stonewall, the one that's coming out through Eagle Entertainment.
Right, through Eagle.
Yeah.
And that is a really low-grade, small film.
Is this foreign language or is it an American film?
No, it's an American film. Right, it's all about the gay rights movement in the 80s, 70s,
okay,
and 80s.
So Stonewall, okay.
So there's that.
Wow, that's interesting.
But the fact that it's...
Which we will have a copy to give away on a future podcast.
Terrific. But the fact that... I know this is pessimistic of me, but the fact that that's being released straight to DVD and through a much smaller distribution arm like Eagle, alarm bells are ringing.
Well, not for me. I mean, that's just because Roland Emmerich doesn't have a reputation for that kind of film. So this doesn't really have an audience, you know.
I know, but if it was any good, they could have probably leveraged it. You know, like
but it doesn't have star power. Like there's mostly unknowns, and you know,
yeah. So does Green Room. Like,
yeah, but that doesn't have like a major release either. Like that's not.
But I got a theatrical at least.
True.
Came out of the movies, like, and it got some good reviews, and it got some momentum behind it.
Yeah.
I could be proven wrong. Stonewall could come out. It could be absolutely.
Well, you haven't even seen the trailer.
Oh, that's true. I haven't. I've only seen a couple of stills. But it's just it's all those elements. It's coming straight to DVD, small distribution,
it's
from a guy
who's known
for big movies.
Like, two more films I want to touch on just real quick. Really quick. Sing Street is worth a look.
Yeah, right.
It's kind of like a new retake on The Commitments.
Right.
With a sort of 80s electro pop kind of style of music, right. As opposed to
looks like it's great, great soundtrack. The Clash,
amazing. I've been listening to it at work. Yeah, it's great. Right. And the other one is Tarzan, which I think was fantastic.
Well, I will briefly swap. I will say something. I won't swap you anything. I'll hand you my handkerchief, and you will hand me a dollar. I will tell you, Swiss Army Man. Fuck, it was an amazing film.
It's
like it just has not left my mind since I saw it, and I didn't know what to make of it at the end. And I should, because normally I can just come out and say I love this movie. But I walked out and I was like, oh, that was like. I've never seen that. That's just, it bridges so many different elements of cinema in a way that I've never seen done before. Just this perfect sequencing of music and visuals, but in terms of the interplay between what's happening on screen, not in a musical fashion, but just in this, I don't know, it's just something else. Like, and it was an experience, and I felt moved by the end of the movie. I came home and showed Danny the trailer and said, this opens next Thursday and we have to go and see it again.
I can't wait.
It looks incredible, yeah.
Just beautiful. Like, God, yeah. I just thinking of that, it makes me feel good and sad.
Yeah.
And everything you say.
And I get kind of like, and it's like, when I got, use your words.
Yeah. I got nothing. Just nothing but feeling right now.
Mr. Crawford, anything you want to add before we move on?
Only thing I want to bring up is a bit of exciting news that I heard today was exciting, but at the same time a little bit disheartening, is the Saw franchise is coming back. They're coming back with Saw 8.
Saw 8.
Right?
I heard that filthy word reboot.
I know, that's what I heard as well. It's
no.
Like, we don't know yet, right? Because what's happening is, I'm a huge fan of the Saw series.
Same.
I really like it, but I'm also the first one to say that yes, it became pretty tiresome towards the end. The last installment, Saw the final chapter. Horror franchises should just not put final in the title.
No, it's not.
Was pretty dull, right? And it was a good time to send it off. up until then, the Saw franchise was predominantly it was an in-house affair. Lionsgate Films, and you know, like Twisted. The production, the Twisted Pictures, and
it had modest origins too.
And everybody who was involved in it was kind of kept in it. Like the production designer and the editor became directors, and the writers wrote all three, and it became like this. And this is the first time that they've kind of stepped out since part two, when Darren Lynn Bousman came on board. And they've just got, they've got new directors, they've got new writers, you know, they've gone away from Marcus Dunstan and Patrick Melton. They've got two new writers on board. However, the exciting news is the directors that they've signed on for the new one is our very own Spearing Brothers.
Yes, I read that.
But I don't know how I feel about this.
Yeah, they're not great directors.
I really liked Predestination. I really liked Daybreakers really good, as well.
And I thought Daybreakers.
Yeah, I really enjoyed those.
I didn't particularly like Undead.
No, I didn't enjoy.
I thought Undead was pretty overhyped.
Tried to watch it twice. So still no closer to liking it. But the other two. And Predestination, I think, was a real achievement. And watching it a second time, I actually enjoyed it more than that.
I've got to revisit it.
I totally agree.
It's great.
Neither here nor there. But the fact that the franchise that I love so much is getting another shot, and probably the best thing they could do is leave all the old people behind and then start new, which is where this reboot thing comes in. Anyway,
I'm excited that they're doing it because it gives me some hope for the franchise, but I'm almost disappointed they're making it because I see them moving on to something bigger than potentially a sequel or reboot.
I love franchises, particularly horror ones, but Saw has come so far. Like, there's so many installments. Where can you go with it?
Yeah.
Will it be another Jigsaw? Will it be a whole new angle with a whole new villain, you know?
Is it time to put Jigsaw to bed?
Yes.
Probably time to put Jigsaw to bed.
Cover me in pig's blood and call me Carrie. And then cut to the trailer.
Okay.
It's the night of the senior prom, and everybody is there, even Carrie White, the girl no one likes, and everyone makes fun of, the girl who lives in that creepy house with her cruel mother. The girl with the strange power. But tonight, no one will laugh at Carrie. She'll be voted queen of the prom. For Carrie, it will be a dream come true. For everyone else, it will be a nightmare. Carrie, a new film by Brian De Palma, starring Sissy Spacek, Piper Laurie, and John Travolta in his first motion picture role. If you have a taste for terror, you have a date with Carrie. Rated R.
So yes, Carrie, 1976, Brian De Palma film based on Stephen King's debut novel. What do we think, boys?
When you said Brian De Palma, in my head, I just heard Grindr De Pumper. I don't know why. I think I was moving my beanie, and I'm like, Grindr De Pumper? His version of Carrie is quite exceptional. what do we think?
The seminal film here.
Yeah, and watching this tonight, this film, I grew up on this film and I loved it as a kid. Admittedly, I watched it maybe about 5 years ago and I absolutely really, really hated it watching it. I was so disappointed, felt it dated so badly. I was actually raging how much I hated it. that night when I was out at a thing with some film people, I'd had a few drinks and suddenly I'm like, what do you think of Carrie? Because I love De Palma and like I've been watching everything that I've missed in De Palma's catalogue, but I've been watching everything else as well. And Carrie, what do you think of Carrie? I was going to say, I fucking hate it now. I fucking hate it. And then, I think I told a few people and they were like, you're crazy. It's actually quite a good film. Watching it tonight, it is a fucking good film. It's a really good film. There's a few style choices that maybe were really great things for 76, innovative sort of things that have dated hard, but the rest of the films, it's solid.
It is so solid.
It's a stylish film to boot, and it's very faithful to the book.
It is very faithful.
I've never read the book.
Yeah, it's a great.
You guys are big on King.
We're big Stephen King.
Yeah, massive Stephen King fan.
And Carrie's an easy read. It's a short book. It's a novella.
Yeah.
And the film stays very true to it. The book. The film gets a lot of the descriptive stuff right down to Carrie's appearance, to the mother. It's really, yeah. really accurately done. I think the film, like I said to you during it, it's kind of, I mean, it's De Palma, so obviously yeah. it's got its style, but it's kind of got a throwback to Hitchcock, and which he does. But Giallo, the colour schemes and the
absolutely. Because there's a lot of like kind of fluoro-y lighting against
close-ups on eyes and lips and it's beautiful.
Oh yeah absolutely.
It's a gorgeous film, and it's one of those ones where it's probably worth noting that as far as De Palma's career goes, it was the 10th film that he made, which is quite something, given it was only it was 40 years ago. He was already 10 feature films in, right? But this, it's probably a toss-up between this and Sisters, which came a couple of years before, where that De Palma...
73, same year as Texas Chainsaw.
Yeah, it did as well. Yeah. You're right. Where that De Palma aesthetic that we know and recognize and hopefully love so much, there was these two films were like the kind of where the Revolver and Rubber Soul of De Palma's career. Those were the films where you can see that switch clicked, where this is now the filmmaker that we know and recognize. But I think he's wise enough not to exploit that aesthetic, that roaming camera, that you know, those great mise-en-scène that he's so good at. We take things like,
because there was opportunity for
there was a lot of opportunity. You know, I mean, like,
he had restraint back then. Yeah, in this period, he had restraint.
The beginning of the film could have quite easily been like that big grand opening shot at the beginning of Donnie Darko, you know, coasting through the school corridors, one take and orientation and all that kind of stuff, where he plays the first two thirds of the film really straight laced.
Absolutely,
it's quite traditional even for a film that's 40 years old.
I wondered too if it was a conscious decision based on what came between Sisters and Carrie was Phantom of Paradise in 74. And that's my favorite De Palma film.
Yeah.
But it was a massive failure. And, at the time, a complete misfire for him. So it felt like
Into obscurity.
Doing a film on a bestseller, and then playing it smart and doing it safe. And even then after this, the next film he did, Obsession, which is probably my second favourite De Palma film. Yeah,
it's incredible.
I wonder. But because there was so much restraint. And sometimes you watch De Palma films and he can't help himself.
Yeah.
He can't. He's indulgent. He's just so... And I fucking love it. And Snake Eyes, I'm with you on that journey. I love that opening. And I think the film's actually pretty good.
I actually think...
I like Snake Eyes.
Snake Eyes, we digress, but Snake Eyes is worth a revisit. Because Snake Eyes is good. Really good. Anyway.
Really entertaining. Yeah, sorry.
Funny you said, though, based on a bestseller, because even it was, but Stephen King wasn't a brand thing.
Yeah, it wasn't a name.
You know, and it's an interesting... way to go, it's the first Stephen King film that was ever made, and we know that they've made dozens,
countless. And he was happy with Carrie.
He was happy.
I think though, I mean, he was happy because he got a lot of money,
of course, and put his name out there. Then 4 years later, he would do, The Shining. Kubrick would do The Shining, and then
however, that four years was very prolific.
Yeah,
there's a lot of stuff like Salem's Lot. Where do you think this stands in terms of Stephen King films? Where do you reckon this one ranks?
For my money, I mean, I don't know. Stephen King films for me sort of fall into two categories. There's the real great ones.
Yes.
There's like The Shawshank Redemption, Stand By Me,
Misery,
Carrie, The Shining. You know, there's all those ones. Yep. And then there's the other ones.
Maximum Overdrive. They're for their own reasons.
Yeah, the kind of hokier ones.
Yeah.
You know, like Desperation and The Langoliers and all those. Like, as much as I hate to say it, a lot of the ones directed by Mick Garris, they're a bit hokier. I think they still have a lot of charm.
They do.
They're very watchable, and I really.
And they're
enjoy
generally
them.
Television films.
Exactly right. Yeah. And they are. If my girlfriend goes out at night, they're the first things that I reach for the DVD player. I would just stick a Stephen King film
this
on.
This is it. The wife would just be completely upset if I watched a Stephen King adaptation without it.
I like the bad ones. I'm riding for Stephen King.
So not the sort of hokier ones, notwithstanding. As far as like the canon, it's certainly out there. Like the better Stephen King ones.
Yeah.
Not least of all because it's a faithful adaptation. One, I'm a firm believer that, and we probably had this argument the other day, is just because something's faithful doesn't necessarily make it good.
Yeah.
But the fact that Carrie is faithful and it just so happens it's directed by a master means that it is head and shoulders above like 90% of the Stephen King adaptations. There's no
and this was an era, obviously following I think with the Academy Awards, it was nominated for 2 Academy Awards. I think Best Actress and Best Supporting Actress.
Best Supporting Actress, I think.
And for a film of this nature, should be recognised for an Academy Awards achievement in itself, because
a blatant horror film.
I don't know if we would see that now. We're in that kind of void at the moment. Maybe in 3 years that the Academy Awards will look at back genre on the again. In
now
a way.
That Mad Max has dominated,
absolutely. And then we've got films like the Neon Demon that's coming out, and these things that are sort of the art horror.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe the Academy will recognise it again.
Let's not forget, it wasn't that many years before that Friedkin
was going to say
was
the
getting
Exorcist.
Nominated for. Best director,
I guess
best
what,
picture so, the Exorcist.
The Exorcist. So it would almost feel like if it's based on a best-selling novel or a novel.
I think,
novel,
though, with Carrie and The Exorcist, what sets them apart is that they are essentially dramas.
Yeah.
That happen within a horror realm,
Yeah.
But it was an interesting time for horror at that time as well, because, think of the titles that were coming out. Like, Carrie, there was The Exorcist, God, there was another one I just had in my head where horror was.
Well, just before The Omen,
exactly. Yeah. It was a very not just profitable and lucrative, but horror was taken with a certain degree of realism and verisimilitude, and it was taken very seriously.
Yeah.
It wasn't kind of hokey, Saw-esque hostile pornography and all that kind of stuff. These were pictures where people could be nominated for Oscars and. Like, name the last time a horror film was. It just doesn't happen anymore.
No, I can't. And it was very off the top of my head.
Yeah, it was a very formative time in horror. Yeah. Halloween was the year after, and like it was a very exciting time for horror. And Carrie, even still back then, along with The Exorcist, is probably the best.
I guess
the
last major horror film was going all the way back to Silence of the Lambs that got the Oscar.
And that was 91.
Yeah. And even then, I don't know if. I don't know if I'd call it straight horror either.
No, but it's classified by many purists as horror.
I totally agree. Yeah. It's certainly got its horror element.
So, interestingly, Stephen King, I think he wrote beforehand, but just after Carrie got released, his novella, which was kind of like a companion story, The Rage, was released, and he banned it himself. He took it off the market because it was a story similar to Carrie about a guy that goes in and opens up on his school, and it's a school massacre story. I can't recall if there's a supernatural element to it. I don't think so. I think it's a blatant, this kid's being pushed to the brink. He goes in with a gun and kills a whole lot of people. And there was a real life massacre that mimicked the book within a couple of months. So Stephen King yanked it from publication, and it now exists on eBay, like first editions, like thousands of dollars.
Wow.
I have a copy at home and I've read it, and it's fucking great. Like, it's really great.
The movie adaptation then completely by name alone.
As in Carrie
and
2?
The Rage, yeah.
Yeah, no, they've used the title as a way of, well, let's kind of salvage that thing that doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, right. And capitalize on something else.
I don't even know if it's capitalizing. I think it's a nod, like just a cheeky nod. But story-wise, there's not a lot of similarities, particularly because it's supernatural. But let's talk about Carrie.
Because it feels like just like a reboot of Carrie, basically, for a teen audience.
Yeah.
I saw it the opening day. It opened in the movies here in Australia, and I was the only one in the cinema.
I saw it at the cinema, two of us,
I think it was on there probably for a week or two.
Yeah.
It was all over. Yeah, I got it on Blu-ray, but I haven't rewatched it since seeing it in the cinema.
I've revisited it a few times, and I kind of like it.
A few times, right.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, because the first time I thought it was shit, but I did buy this double pack because it's got the miniseries and I want to see that miniseries.
It's got two of the American Pie guys in it.
Chris Klein, is he in it?
No.
No.
Who's the guy that plays Shitbrick?
Eddie
something or other, yes, and Mina Savari, she's in it too. She plays a goth chick.
Oh, she is as well.
And you got the guy from Home Improvement that gets his balls.
Jonathan Taylor Thomas. No, the ugly brother. Yeah, the ugly brother, the one that no girls had crushes on. My wife didn't have posters of that ugly kid in her bedroom for sure. It was Taylor Thomas.
To further expand the Carrie universe, of course, they made a stage production, a musical.
Have you seen that?
No.
And the did a remake with Angela Bettis in 2002.
That's the mini series. Yeah, that's in the pack with the Rage. Yeah, I haven't watched that either.
I haven't watched it. I don't see a lot of merit.
I heard it was
but
all
I
right.
like Angela Bettis. I like her a lot.
I heard it's all right.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know.
But it's a short story. Like, how do you drag that out?
Yeah, they stretch it out to maybe 3 hours because I think it's screened over 2 nights in the States, possibly.
fucking insane to me.
Yeah, it does. And then of course, but she's great. Angela Bettis is great. Yeah. Like just as an actress. May. Like that's a Carrie reference right there. That
absolutely.
Film. But then there was a 2013 remake, which you like a lot.
Which I don't like a lot. I do like it. I think it's all right. It works. What I really would like to see is the director's cut of that film.
Because I agree.
It was ripped out of her hand and they recut it. And apparently she was trying to get as many people on board to say, I can still do this. The footage still exists. Let's recut it for DVD and we'll get it out on DVD and Blu-ray. The studio didn't want to listen. They did go with, I think, an extended version for the DVD release, but it wasn't the director's cut.
I think the biggest problem with that one, shame. The casting was horrendous.
Oh, you're
going to
say that Chloe
Grace Moretz.
Yeah, she's an ugly, you know. No, she's true. No, she's not.
She's a good-looking girl and Carrie's in the book is not a good-looking girl. And that's the whole point of why she's so stigmatised and, you know.
Well, I find it very difficult watching Sissy Spacek on screen and it was much easier to watch this young
but that's
lovely
the
girl.
Power of the film. It's unsettling. Yeah. It's unsettling. You're uncomfortable.
It was very uncomfortable.
I mean, there was a lot of things that happened in the film that were unsettling, but not necessarily. I mean, like, outside of the fact that it is an insanely oppressive film, it is no wonder Carrie White just goes bananas and murders everybody because she is arguably the
deliberately
worst.
Deliberately so.
Yeah. But she's arguably the worst treated teenager in the history of cinema. Like, it's bonkers, right? But the things that I found unsettling was a byproduct of the time that the film was made. The opening scene, for instance, the famous opening scene where all these, we know that at the time, Nancy Allen was 27 and John Travolta was 22 and PJ Souls was 26. Like they're all, but they're playing teenagers.
Yeah.
And now we're presented with teenage girls, full frontal nudity in a shower. That just feels wrong to me. That feels wrong. Yeah. Teachers hugging students and beating them over the head with books. That feels wrong to me. And it's like all these things make it really unsettling. And they probably were pretty commonplace 40 years ago when the film was made.
Oh yeah, Porky's. I mean, that was
exactly right. But now, watching them, you know, in a different world, all these things just help make Carrie this little bit more horrible and this little bit more unsettling and this little bit more terrifying, so that when she does finally snap, it's perfectly justifiable because that's not the world we live in anymore. Snap, it's mental, but it's a really unsettling film as a result.
Well, here's a few degrees of separation. You accidentally let slip Nancy Travis's name then.
Yes.
And she was in Rose Red, the Stephen King story.
Yeah, she was.
Right? Rose Red opening sequence has all the rocks raining on this house and destroying it. I don't know if you remember that.
I don't.
Originally, in the finale of Carrie, they had rocks raining down and destroying the house, which when you watch the movie, the interior shots have these holes appearing because these rocks were supposed to be coming through.
Right.
And it didn't look good, so they changed it to a fire and a collapse. So that's where Rose Red recycled the concept and put that in there. Okay, interesting.
That's a surprise because that would have cost quite a lot of money.
Apparently, the footage was shot, but it just looked like rain, so they ditched it. Had like small pebbles and stuff.
Because Carrie had a pretty modest budget for the time, even. I think it was about $1.8 million.
Yeah.
And Brian De Palma had a bit of an argument with the studio. He went back to them and said it's going to cost 1.8, and they said, "Oh, we need to get it done by 1.6." And he said, "Well, it's going to get done by 1.8. And then they said, "Okay, pack it up. We'll shut it down." Brian De Palma came back to them and goes, maybe we can make it happen for 1.6. So they gave him the film back, and then he made it, and it cost 1.8. But just to put it in perspective, a year later, Star Wars would come out, and Star Wars cost $11 million. Also that same year, William Friedkin's Sorcerer would come out 12 months later, and that cost $21 million. The whole budget of Carrie was 1.8. The bridge sequence, for anybody who's seen Sorcerer, the bridge itself was built and engineered for that film, cost more than the entire budget of Carrie.
Incredible.
Cost $2 million.
Incredible. But what a sequence it is.
One of Sidney's best.
It is jaw-dropping.
Oh my God,
my point is that for a film where the budget was obviously quite tight, to shoot a sequence like that and then sort of get rid of it would seem... It would have to look pretty horrible, I think, for them to ditch it completely.
But still, it happened, but apparently the footage exists.
I would love to see that.
Yes.
Well, if the footage is still around, hopefully maybe it'll turn up on that Scream Factory release that's being released in September. So, 4K scan.
Anything else you want to add to Carrie?
No, just
we've milked it. I reckon we've talked it.
It was a lot better than I mean, like, I always had fond memories of it, but looking at it now with adult eyes, it's actually
helped having Blu-ray.
It helps having Blu-ray, yeah. And I watching it on a Jared's TV. It's the size of my fucking dining table. It stands up. It's a really good film, and the techniques that De Palma uses haven't dated that much, even if the style that's on screen has. It's pretty timeless. It's pretty good.
Yeah, it's beautifully shot. Yeah, it's that's gorgeous. For sure. I think more so it's the post production. Some of the editing decisions are the ones that, you know, made me feel a little uneasy with the film. Yeah, especially after. Well, I don't. You know, hopefully, you've seen Carrie, because I think we've said a lot about it. But I just wanted to ask you guys before we wrap. What would be one of your favourite De Palma films? You know?
Phantom of Paradise.
Yeah.
You reckon Phantom of Paradise?
Yeah, I love it. I love it because it's so weird and it just it looks...
feels like there's something new in it every time you watch it.
Yeah, it's a really bold fantasy, like surrealist thing.
It's just incredible, but and with De Palma's eye. It's like he's basically being given, you know, the ability to do anything he wants. You can do it. Do whatever you want. I'm going to make the craziest rock opera ever.
And
you're like, oh, I don't know about the sound of that. Oh, no, it's amazing.
Oh, no,
it's
incredible. Even think, like, I mean, it's far from being near his best, but I like Redacted quite a bit. I think that was quite interesting.
Redacted was one of it's about worth it.
Five that I'm sitting on. Redacted, I've never seen.
Yeah. I reckon my favorite is probably Dress to Kill, to be honest.
Right. Dress to Kill, yeah.
I think Dress to Kill. And although it's not a very popular decision, I really like Femme Fatale.
I only watched that
three, 4 years ago, and I was surprised by how good it is. It's a very traditional De Palma type of thriller.
It's a very straight-laced thriller told through that.
It just came around at a really weird cinematic landscape.
The timing was way out. And the advertising, like the video slick for, because I don't know if it played theatrically.
It's really slick.
I just remember going straight to DVD in Queensland at least, and it just looked like another sexy thriller that looked a bit
wasn't.
And I avoided it, and I regretted it, because I watched it with Danny 3-4 years ago, and I turned to her and got,
does that have a Blu-ray release?
Waited so many years to that. No, DVD only at this stage,
and even then DVD is probably deleted by now.
I think I picked up an rental copy off eBay for about $4 or $5 when I was trying to get all the De Palma.
You'll have to raid caches.
Oh no, I've got it. I've got just about everything De Palma made, but I think the only one that I don't have is Phantom of the Paradise, to be honest.
Get onto it.
I have to get onto it too.
Take it away, Jarrett.
Okay, so...
I love it when he does that. He just completely throws you under the fucking bus every chance he gets.
I was ready to just, like, take it and run with it. We're going to do... I don't have a song about Forgotten Gems.
Forgotten Gems!
Oh. Is that Forgotten Gems?
That's... Or is that... That's
everything.
Guilty pleasure!
No, that's normally guilty pleasure. Put it away, Sean. Sean, tell us, what are you bringing to the table for Forgotten Gems this week?
I love that. Well played. All right, are we doing the guessing game?
Yeah,
okay, I'm up for it. An Irish film?
Irish film.
Oh, shit. Okay, yeah.
Well played.
Yeah, The Matchmaker with Ginny Groffler. Circle of Friends with that other bird, Driver.
There's a difference between a film being shot
in Ireland
and being an Irish film.
Matchmaker was directed by an Aussie.
It was as well. Bruce Beresford, wasn't it?
No, and Mark Joffrey or whatever his name was.
Oh, it was as well.
Who did Spotswood.
Ah, yes. In the Name of the Father with Daniel Day-Lewis.
Now we're just nerding out. Come on, all right.
Okay, 1998, Irish film. Stars Brendan Gleeson.
Oh, he's in all of them. The General.
Yes.
This is one of those ones that I feel like just doesn't get the recognition that it probably deserves.
Yeah.
It's this nice, quiet, deceptively... It seems simple, but it's a deceptively complex little drama about an Irish folklore hero, kind of like their version of a Ned Kelly-esque kind of... Larrikin. Have you seen it?
I don't know. I remember it.
Yeah.
And I remember because at the time when it came out, it was really well reviewed.
Yeah.
And it was all and the talk.
Just
And video stores got shit slowed because I think we cut a really good deal on the VHS for that one.
Oh, really?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
But and it was, tell me and it was, the actual story, and the premise.
It was written and directed by John Berman. And at the time, it was almost like a step back to John Berman quality of films that we'd sort of come to expect from the man. Because it was like... And it's about this Irish folklore hero. I say folklore hero. He's basically like a Robin Hood called Martin Cahill, right? Who grew up in this disimpoverished Irish poor neighborhood. And as he grows up, he becomes a thief. But he's this kind of love, this guy you just love to hate. He's so goddamn charming. He's so funny and amiable. And he knows everybody. And he's got his fingers in all these pies. He's got his fingers in his wife and her sister. Like, he's a total rascal. And John Voight, an old Berman colleague, he shows up and he's the cop who's trying to bring him down. And Martin Cahill performs two particularly big robberies in his life. And it's the story of these robberies, the fallout of these robberies, and the cops trying to get him, all the while sticking it to the police in this kind of lovable, larrikin way. I'm not going to tell you anything more, just that is it. Mm-hmm. It is such a flawless film. Like, in my humble opinion, it is 5 stars, as good as it gets. Why nobody talks about this film is completely beyond me. Everybody in it, even John Voight, who has a tendency sometimes to lean particularly right into caricature.
Yeah.
And he keeps it just on the right side of great. Brendan Gleeson is amazing. If you need to know how good it is, Hollywood co-financed another film called Ordinary Decent Criminal.
Mm-hmm. Oh, with Kevin Spacey. With
Kevin Spacey.
I never watched that either. Peter Mullen. I'm a Netflix queue for 3 years.
Yeah, and Peter Mullen, who's a Scotsman, and Colin Farrell, long before he became famous. And it's the exact same story of Martin Cahill.
Right.
But it's complete horseshit.
Yeah.
It's terrible. And if you watch them both back to back, Ordinary Decent Criminal's obviously got all the money, the general's a bit more independent. The general just leaps and bounds ahead of it.
Yeah,
and
I loved it.
It's an incredible little film.
I haven't watched it in such a long time, but I remember thinking that this is the movie that Buster should have been. Do you remember the Phil Collins movie, Buster?
Yeah, yeah, exactly right.
Which I do like Buster.
Yeah, but
the car chase in the middle is incredible.
I was a kid when I watched it.
The soundtrack was incredible.
So good.
Yeah, so I have a soft spot because as a kid, I thought it was great.
Yeah.
But when I saw the general, I thought, well, maybe this is how Buster should have been.
I never thought of that, but you're right, it is. Anyway, if you haven't seen it,
it's definitely worth it.
I'm going to revisit because I loved it when I saw it.
Yeah, and it's one of those ones. I think I over the course of it was released in 1998, and it's, you know, obviously 18 years old now. I think over the course of the 18 years, I must have seen it 10 times, and I never get bored of it, just because he is so he's not a handsome guy, he's not a fit guy, he's ugly and he's fat, but you just fucking want to be just like
Mark Cartwright. Yeah.
He's so charming. It's so worth it.
Awesome. Jared.
I have to watch that, The General. Yeah. Glenn,
did that just deflect?
That's twice he's done that.
Boom.
What did you have this week, folks?
All right. I've got a 1990 film that revolves around the New York mob.
1990 film Mobsters? About the New York mob.
No. It is a comedy.
I have a feeling is Mobsters set in Chicago?
I don't know.
Yeah, possibly.
Yeah, I think
this is the first thing.
It's not Mobsters.
Good
And it's not Family Business.
Family Business.
Family Business had...
Is that one with Sean Connery and Matthew Broderick?
And Dustin Hoffman.
And Matthew Broderick?
Matthew Broderick.
Yeah, he was doing a lot of films like The Freshman and that.
Boom!
Ah, The Freshman!
The Freshman!
I only watched that recently on Crackle.
I watched it last week and...
Is this the one with... Marlon Brando.
Yeah, and a giant Komodo dragon?
This film is so much better than I remember. Yeah. It holds up so well.
Really?
Yeah, and De Palma's in it. All these fucking directors of Hollywood are scattered in this movie. It's so filmic, you know? Because Matthew Broderick plays a film student that moves to New York and gets hoodwinked by Bruno Kirby, who's fucking a legend.
I love Bruno
And he's
Kirby.
So good in this film. And, you know, just gets duped and tricked into working for New York's biggest mob boss, who in the film apparently was the inspiration for the Don in The Godfather. Mm. So Marlon Brando plays himself as the Godfather. And everyone keeps looking at him saying, aren't you, you know, Don? It's just such a great, clever film. The Komodo Dragon, Frank Wiley's in it.
Yes.
And these two bumbling over this giant lizard. It's hilarious. It's clever. The story of what the mobsters are up to, they're importing exotic animals that are on the brink of extinction. and they're cooking them for the world's richest.
That's right.
And yeah, that's how the mob are making their money. That's and right. It's so unusual.
It's such a strange premise. Yeah.
But a good one.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Very original.
So I love this film. Matthew Broderick's great in it. I mean, he was on top of his game, I thought, back then. Absolutely. And this came a year after Family Business. So that's two mob movies back to back. And there's not much more to say other than the interesting story about Brando, though. Being Brando, he's quite renowned for throwing tantrums and whatnot. Yeah. He demanded an extra $1 million when the production was extended for 1 week, right? And when the producers refused, Brando went on TV and publicly slammed the film.
Wow.
He got his money, and then he went and praised it.
Amazing.
Yep.
Amazing.
Brando. And talked it up as one of the greatest things. And his performance in this, I think, is one of his best. Like, the way he and Broderick play off each other, even Bruno Kirby on the sidelines,
has
this thing with Brando that's really genuine. Yeah. Yeah, it's good. Great film.
So did we say that was 90 or 91?
1990.
And The Island of Dr. Moreau was like 6 years later. And God, he just descended into...
Yeah.
Madness.
Yeah. Looked awful.
He had a lot of personal woes at that time too, so probably factored into
obviously,
it.
Broderick, when Broderick was on top of his game, Broderick was great.
Let's just say Broderick is on top of his game still, because he's a Broadway legend now.
That's true, he is.
When he was on his film game,
he's married to Sarah Jessica Parker, or are they not married and they're just one of these couples that live together? I don't know.
I don't know.
I don't know if they're married.
No. Yeah, but even just now, he's still popping. You're right, he does. He pops up every so often. Did you see that film, Peter Tolan directed it, called Finding Amanda?
Yeah.
Where he plays the degenerate gambler
who has to
go to Vegas to find his daughter, his niece, who he thinks has become a prostitute or a stripper or something.
That was a great role for him.
That was amazing.
That was around when he did Election,
But that was one that just slipped under the radar, if you haven't seen that. And but when Broderick is on point, he is fucking on fire. He is so charming. He's just really amiable and easy.
I even liked him in that Deck the Halls with Danny DeVito. There's that scene where they're like at the Christmas show, and Danny DeVito and him are rivals, right? And these girls are dancing as these mini skirts, flashing their asses at the crowd. And Matthew Broderick's chanting, like, "Who's your daddy? Who's your daddy?" She spins around, and it's his daughter. He's like, "I'm her daddy."
Oh, Jesus.
But this is a kid's movie. Yeah, totally. And Broderick delivers it so well. Anyway, the freshman.
We do feel bad, though. He is married to Sarah Jessica Parker. Maybe you don't feel so bad about that.
I don't know. I really don't like her. She used to come into my cafe in New York.
Did she?
Well, none of the times I was there.
And you were chuffed?
No, I wasn't.
Like, can you sign my copy of Sex in the City?
2.
yes. I love it when you go to the desert.
I would have thrown a Flight of the Navigator at her, but anyway.
I'd have thrown a fucking chair at her.
Jared, we're not going to do yours. We'll move on.
So, all right, cool.
Please.
So tell me...
that was genius. Well, sorry.
Yeah, mine's like on the cusp of obscurity and forgotten gem. Now, why I will say that is because I didn't actually know this film. Well, I did, and I didn't know this film existed until last Sunday.
Right.
Last Sunday, I saw on the Fangoria feed. They posted a poster for a film. And it was like, oh, you know, what about this forgotten classic?
I really hope it's not one I've got lined up for an obscurity.
It was called The New Kids.
No, it's not.
Okay. Really. And I was like, The New Kids.
Sorry, is it actually called The New Kids?
The New Kids is the title, right?
So we don't get to guess.
No, we don't get to guess.
No, there was no way you
always say that, but just because you didn't know it existed.
Do you know about The New Kids?
I know the name.
Do you know about The New Kids?
No, because
who directed The New Kids?
Why are you asking me that? I don't know.
I should have gone for you at that. On the poster, right? Great classic 80s artwork.
Terrible title.
Right at the top. Yeah, not great, but when you see the title treatment, it works. Like in the whole poster, sometimes the title's just shit, but when you see a poster and you're like, that makes sense. The top says, from the director of Friday the 13th, and I'm like, looked up, from the director of Sean S. Cunningham. And then it has this huge, one of those... you know, like 6-line sort of, you know, tag. It's not a tagline. It's pretty much like the synopsis on the poster and not on the back of the bloody jacket of the DVD or video. Anyway, it set the premise.
Gives you the whole premise. Pretty much
everything.
It
painted the whole picture. And I was like, great. And then I'm looking at the picture and it's this, you know, beautiful illustration of Lori Loughlin and some other guy that I don't know who he was. I think his name's Shannon Presby or something like that. I've never heard of him. Never really went on to do anything, so it doesn't matter. Let's fucking forget him. So they're there. And then the title, The New Kids. And I thought, is this a mock poster? Because I don't know this film exists. It can't it's this illustration's too beautiful for me to be seeing it the first time. And Lori Loughlin's in it. Same as she did as my secret admirer.
Mm.
Super hot Lori Loughlin era. Anyway, I had an idea of this film. I couldn't believe it. And then I searched and I found that someone had uploaded it to YouTube, but I didn't want to watch that dodgy copy. It turns out it was on iTunes US. So I rented it Sunday night, cost me $3.99. I watched it with Danny and I'll get to what I thought of it. But then I also just discovered for our listeners and for you guys, it's actually on fucking Crackle for free.
Wow.
You can watch it on Australian Crackle.
That's where I've seen it because I scroll through Crackle all the time.
But here's the kicker, right? So we watch the movie and I'll give you a basic premise of the story. It's these two kids that are kind of military brats. They're, you know, the old man's in the army and he's this fucking war hero and it's played by Tom Atkins. And I lost my shit when the opening credits come up and his name, like, Tom Atkins is even in this. This is a fucking brand. I said to Danny, it's brilliant. But then I realized he was their father. And the synopsis for the film said, shortly after losing their parents, two right. kids, I'm like, well, fuck it, he's not going to be in it for long. I hope there's some flashbacks. Well, no, there wasn't. And he literally is in it for the first 5 minutes. And the 5 minutes are great that he's in it. But the two kids, the parents pass away in a, I think they say a car wreck, but it doesn't really matter. They move to this small town where they go and live with their uncle and their auntie, who have like an old amusement park that they're putting together slowly. And it's kind of like one of those tourist traps. Oh, it's off the beaten road, but you know, it's going to get popular one day and people will be coming this way when they build a new freeway and they want to come here because it's on the way to Disneyland because they moved Florida.
You're giving a bigger fucking synopsis than the poster.
Totally. I'm building a little bit of mood. Anyway, they encounter some, you know, bad kids at school, and these bad kids will stop at nothing to absolutely terrorize them. And these are the baddest kids you've seen since Class of 1984. And here's the thing, the score in the movie, very similar to Class of 1984. Guess who the composer was?
The same Harry, as Class of 1984.
Yeah, the same guys in 1984.
Yeah, you know his name.
Harry Gregson Williams.
Starts with an L.
LS. Oh, Lalo Schifrin.
Yes, and the score is so fucking similar. And the films are about 3 years, 4 years apart. So damn similar that I played a scene for Class 94 for Danny.
Did they use the leftovers?
Feels a bit like it. But anyway, it is so intense. These kids do all number of things to the two orphan children. And sooner or later, you know, the kids, you know, they've had enough and they strike back. And therein is the Australian release of the title is actually called Striking Back. The film was called Striking Back on video, used completely different art.
Don't remember that one.
And it came out like 3 years after the US. And I remember that video cover. It was rated R, RCA Columbia Pictures Toys, because I remember picking it up. Nothing about fucking Friday 13th on the cover, different artwork. And it would always be in the action section. Like, nah, I won't watch it.
Yeah.
Nah, so I avoided it for years. But seemingly I've talked about this film with quite a few people this week because it was this really lost film in my mind and people are aware of it under that Striking Back title. Mm. Like, yeah, no, that's a really cool film. I haven't seen that for like 20 years.
Yeah.
Where can you see it? Well, apparently you can watch on Crackle for fucking free. Don't pay $4 to watch it in HD. Although
like,
it did actually
like an asshole. Really like, yeah.
It's, yeah.
And Crackle gives you commercials.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah. That said, I looked at it streaming and it is pretty shit quality, but I said to Danny, I gotta save $4 US just watching on this thing, and you know, would add to the atmosphere of it. Yeah. It is a fucking cool film in terms of cast part from Lori Loughlin and Tom Atkins. You got James Spader, bleach blonde hair, evil as fuck. I mean, so evil he even calls Lori Loughlin a cunt. And sorry, I don't know if I should. Yeah, well, it's not like a Christmas episode or anything. And
what has he never stopped you before?
No, it's true. I just kind of, I was like, huh.
He's now, in his own house now.
I just kind of, like, I'm in my own element.
And I'll do whatever I want. But I'll call baby seals.
But when I'm at your house.
Yeah,
when I'm at your house, I'm busting cunt out. There is a really great line from the uncle when he's talking about the theme park and how successful the theme park will be when, you know, when they build that new highway or something like that this way and the people come this way.
If only the viewers could see
his hands. I know, that's exactly what I was
My little shuffles and neck movements.
He's jiving in his chair here, like he's shuffling his shoulders and he's like, I love it when he gets, every so often he'll fight a film and he's really excited, bounces in his chair and he's a fucking motorbike, so he just can't stop him.
Okay, so the quote, it's exactly true. So this is what the uncle says to describe how successful they'll be, you know, when the park takes off. He says, soon we'll be farting through silk. Right. It's like, I rewound it. I was like, what? And I said to Danny, I'm pretty sure he said they'll be farting through silk. And rewound it. Oh, he did. And then I wrote it in my phone for later because I'm like, oh, I'll be talking about this film. And I haven't mentioned that line to anyone. So that's it, boys.
Exclusive.
Farting through silk. Why isn't that part of just like the common, just,
yeah,
common language? Natural, like, yeah, exactly. Anyway, if you see it as the new kids, you can check it out on Crackle. Otherwise, you can get an old video of it as Striking Back, but it definitely earns an R rating because it is brutal.
I need a fucking sleep brutal. After
okay,
that.
Okay, so and so that was a taste of the new sideshow we've got coming called The Jarrett Show, coming to a podcast near you.
Well, once that highway opens up, it's going to be really successful.
First thing was intercourse.
Oh, all right, Sean. Yes, wrapping this up. Take it away,
sir.
What with? What's he taking it away with?
I wanted to see what he'd say.
Oh, okay. We'll do it.
Thanks for coming, boys. I'm with you guys.
Well, don't forget we are on SoundCloud once again, as well as all the other platforms. And Jarrett's collection update. I want to touch on that.
I have no idea what's happening there. I really don't.
It's been a little while.
It has, yeah. I've just
he's been busy.
Have I? Did I? I said I was starting a new job, didn't I?
Yeah, yeah.
But
you
I
started a new job. To be fair, he's making a TV show.
Yes. Oh, there's the TV show.
Please buy some.
But
space.
I am going to. Yeah, I'm going to catch up, and I did bring a camera home with me. And my boss has actually told me not to come in on Monday. Take all my stuff with me. they've given me a day in lieu for Monday for the weekend we went to Beechworth. So I brought the camera home. I'm like, well, I'm home Monday.
Yeah.
So I'm going to make an episode. And I will show you this. It's too much work, but I took photos of all the stuff I bought, but then I put it into the collection. Because I didn't want it to be messy, but then I knew with the photo go.
Well, that's pretty useless on a podcast.
You know. Yeah, no, that's not for the audience. That's for me to know when I do the collection.
Well, the audience are listening.
Yeah, no, but you didn't even see the photo.
Why did I did.
What I
there is no photo. It's a like screen. He's
no, he had that fucking red thing on there.
Like that?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that doesn't
count. That's a killer. That's a killer tomorrow.
Yeah, that's not the photos of the DVD. No, it's not a killer. This has descended into madness. I feel like Marlon Brando on the set of The Island of Dr. Moreau. Definitely not the freshman because he was still commanding good cash in that.
And he lip kissed Matthew Broderick in that.
Yeah, Matthew Broderick would count that as one of his greatest screen moments. That and acting alongside the monkey in Project X. Let's not talk about Ferris Bueller's Day Off or, you know, the producers or anything like
acting
that.
Acting alongside that pedophile Mr. Rooney.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah, well, you know.
Mother of God, can we wrap this up? This is.
I believe it's time.
Okay, so please drop us a comment, join in the conversation, and that is us for another episode. It's episode 29.
Woo!
Bang!
See you next time.
Goodbye.
See ya.